Labor's Indigenous Affairs spokeswoman Linda Burney says she's losing hope that the federal government will deliver on its promise of a referendum on an Indigenous voice to Parliament. But one of the delegates to the convention that developed the Uluru Statement calling for a First Nations voice is more hopeful. Thomas Mayer has travelled around the country with the Uluru Statement and says that his 26,000-kilometre journey has given him hope that the Australian people will vote yes. He's just released a book about his journey, Finding the Heart of the Nation, and he joined me earlier to talk about it. Thomas Mayer, welcome back to the world today and congratulations on your book.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks a lot, Eleanor.
The last time we spoke, you said you had faith in the Indigenous Affairs Minister, Ken Wyatt. Now Labor's Indigenous Affairs spokeswoman, Linda Burney, has come out saying she's losing hope that the government will deliver the referendum on an Indigenous voice to Parliament within this term. Are you still confident it will happen?
I'm confident it'll happen, but whether it happens under this government is another question. And I share Linda Burney's concerns. If a voice is only legislated, we know it'll be destroyed one day, like ATSIC and all our other representative bodies. I think it will happen, though, because, you know, I talk to children in the schools and this great listening that I've done, people are ready. The next generation is definitely going to support this. So it's just a matter of when. The thing about that is our people are dying, and so this is urgent. We've got to continue to put pressure on Ken Wyatt and the Morrison government and tell them they need to put this referendum to the people and get the job done.
Now, you spent 18 months travelling around the country with the Uluru Canvas. Where did the idea for taking that journey come from, and what were you hoping to achieve?
Well, the idea came about because in 2017, I held the statement for the first time, the large canvas that the Yanagu women have painted Jukapur on, so the song lines, and with all the names of the people that endorsed the statement and the statement printed in the middle. And I held that canvas and I just felt the power of it, you know. I knew that the people had to see it.
Describe that moment at the Uluru meeting when the statement from the heart was first read out aloud.
It was an electric feeling, and you know, in that moment, I saw people that had been in passionate debate against one another, embracing each other with tears in their eyes. You know, just the joy and hope was there, and it's inspired me for the journey that I took.
And how concerned were you about having responsibility for the canvas itself as you travelled around?
Oh, it was a huge responsibility. I mean, this canvas is one of a kind. It's sacred now. It came from the heart of Australia and from such a wonderful moment. And there was a few times where I lost it, you know.
Really?
But very soon found it. Went on a different plane a couple of times. They were very scary moments.
So you say travelling around the country with the Uluru Canvas changed you. How?
Well, to take the time to listen to people, you know, and really listen to people is something that a lot of us don't really do, you know. So to write this book, I had to deeply listen, and that was life-changing, you know. And as I did that, I knew that the book was the right thing to do because I hoped that I could help other people listen to the really compelling reasons why the Uluru Statement and a First Nations voice enshrined in the Constitution is so important and so visionary and nation-building. The reality is that in common for all of those people that I interviewed was the experience of racism, the effects of, you know, our past and our present policy failures, all those things that have hurt our people, stolen generations, incarceration. But also what was common was the hope, you know, and the generosity and the vision towards a better future.
And you say also that so often the most powerful emotion was pride. Can you explain that?
Yeah. People were proud of surviving, you know. I mean, we have survived through an incredible amount of adversity, purposeful division of our people, and continued attempts to wipe out our culture and diminish who we are. And who we are is this 60,000-year-old culture. And so there is a lot of pride there, and we should all be proud of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. We are the oldest continuous culture in the world, and there were really complex and successful social structures and the way that we dealt with each other as many First Nations sharing this continent.
And you say that in any other nation, we would celebrate these stories, this 60,000 years of history. Why do you think that here in Australia, we don't?
Oh, it's just an ignorance, continuing the great Australian silence. The colonisation was justified through terra nullius, and to maintain that falsity, we had to ignore that we existed. But I think there is a turnaround on that, and people are starting to change, and I think this book will help.
You've had the opportunity to know your culture, your Torres Strait Islander heritage. Yet even on the land that you grew up on, Larrakia land, other First Nations people couldn't know their culture because it had already been erased. How does that affect the relationships between First Nations people, that some have their songs and their stories in their language and some don't?
Well, it's hurtful amongst our people, you know, this the difference of the impact of colonisation. And one of the people that I interview is a Larrakia man. And I grew up with him, and we would island dance, and our Aboriginal mates, our Larrakia mates, would join us. And to be honest, it wasn't until adulthood that this was really felt. And you know, listening to my friend talk about it, and he said that he was proud and happy to practice with us our Torres Strait Islander culture, but as a Larrakia person, he was really sad that you know, he would never learn his own. And the impact of Darwin, you know, being built on Larrakia country and the tribe almost being completely wiped out. I mean, the Larrakia are who the Yolngu people talk about in the Yirrkala Bark petitions. They wanted to avoid the fate of the Larrakia people in the 1963 Yirrkala Bark petition. My friend who talks in the book lives that reality.
And you say in your book that it took you a long time to understand why your dad didn't tell you more earlier about your own Torres Strait Islander culture. What was the reason for that?
Oh, I think my dad is a proud man and had moved so far from home in the Torres Strait to Darwin, and he just needed to get on with his life, I think. And it was frustrating for me as a young man with a different world from when he moved over here, I suppose, when I had grown up a bit, and just so eager to learn more. And even my father now has changed a lot. You know, he can embrace his culture more than when he first moved here and had to fit in.
You say that it's a different world, just even between your dad's generation and yours. Did you experience racism?
Yeah, absolutely. It's something that I have in common with all the people in the book. You know, just the ignorant comments that people make, or the way people will treat you different. It's something that we all experience. And my mum says, my mum is non-Indigenous, and she said she came to the realisation very early that it didn't matter what the full heritage that we had, you know, that I had a non-Indigenous mother, people would look at us, her children, and to them we're black, and that's the racism that we'd need to experience in life.
Even despite the loss of a lot of the culture, one of the things that strikes me about your book is just how much culture survives and how many Indigenous people speak multiple First Nations languages.
Yeah. I mean, it's something that we should celebrate, you know, this diversity that we have within our nation, that there's still remains to be, you know, hundreds of languages, different First Nations languages. And to embrace that, I think we need to enshrine our voices in the Constitution, those abilities and that background in the Constitution.
How have non-Indigenous Australians that you've encountered on your travels responded to the Uluru Statement?
Well, in my travels, I've spoken to, it would be tens of thousands of people. And in the non-Indigenous community, and even in little towns like Violet Town in Victoria, non-Indigenous people, if you just explain it to them, if you take the time and help them listen, then it's overwhelming support. And going to Barangaroo, I wasn't sure if I would be helping the campaign with the corporate sector. And going up there, you know, and speaking to that crowd, you know, I mean, there was standing acclamation when you read the statement. And to me, when I'd experienced speaking to the people at Barangaroo, to Aboriginal communities, the, you know, the remotest Aboriginal communities and everything in between, I realised that we have the ingredients for change here, and all we need to do now is convince Parliament to take it to the people. We will win this referendum to enshrine a voice like we did in 67 with over 90% support. I'm sure we will, because I see it. I was in a school in Fremantle, and a young fellow, I think he was only about 13, came up to me and he said, "My family says a lot of racist things, but I'm not going to be like that," which is a really touching moment. You know, this kid had the bravery to come up to me and say that. And the only thing that's missing really is the leadership in Parliament.
There's also a call for treaties in the Uluru Statement. Is that something that frightens non-Indigenous Australians a bit more? Did you find that as you were travelling around?
No, I think treaty has moved on, as in the acceptance that the Australian people have for the need to have a settlement of what's happened in the past, a treaty and agreement on how we can move forward. I can't even think of any pushback against treaty in any of those discussions that I've had. And so I think Australia is ready for treaty making.
The Uluru Statement from the Heart is written to the Australian people, not to the government. But can the referendum succeed without support from all the politicians in the Australian Parliament?
It'll be very precarious without the support of Parliament. Firstly, Parliament needs to pass a referendum bill. But then if we don't do the work to see that parliamentarians support this and support a yes campaign, then it's going to be much more difficult. But people have a lot less faith in politicians today. We haven't had a referendum in a long time. It's the digital age. And the people are different in their thinking to politicians on this matter. So I think we could win it as long as it gets put to the people.
Thomas Mayer, thanks so much for speaking to us and congratulations again on your book.
Thanks, Eleanor.
And Thomas Mayer's book is called Finding the Heart of the Nation.